Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to take a look at, in fact, the next two half-hour segments, at the European Monetary Union. This is something that is taking shape as I speak in late June of 1998, and it's something which, sadly, is not receiving a great deal of attention. It is a profound event. It could be viewed in many ways as the decisive event of the 20th century, signal event of the 20th century. In my opinion, the events that have taken place in this century are in many ways being capped, that's the proper term, by this particular crowning event of the 20th century, and yet it is largely going unnoticed. In a couple of half-hour segments recently recorded, I described some of the major tides of capital or capital flows in the 20th century, running from North America to Europe, from occupied Europe to neutral countries, from North America to Europe again in the wake of World War II. The net effect of the total of these capital flows has been not only to make Germany the most powerful nation in Europe, whereas going into this century, the most powerful nation in Europe was Great Britain. But in my opinion, it is altogether probable that in the next century, Germany will emerge as the most powerful nation on Earth. We will see, but certainly the European Monetary Union would appear to be a vehicle which could help to effect just that. I've spoken about the European Monetary Union in a previous half-hour segment. It is, in an historical sense, the fulfillment of a plan put forward by Friedrich Liszt in the 1840s, who advocated an economically united Europe under German domination as a vehicle for unseating Britain as the dominant imperial power in the world. Well, that was Friedrich Liszt in the 1840s, and he formulated the plan that is now being realized through the European Monetary Union. Bear in mind, though, that in the late 1990s, the dominant power on Earth is the United States. We are no longer the dominant target of the von Liszt-ian plan, or the Liszt-ian plan, now being put into effect in Europe. There are many theories about just what's going to happen with regard to the euro. I've stated in the past that if it's a weak currency, it's very likely to devastate the American economy, particularly in concert with the Asian currency devaluations, which are disrupting the American balance of trade. The U.S. trade deficits are way up. A weak euro is likely to produce a flight to the dollar, making the dollar prohibitively strong and choking off American manufactured exports, which would, as a result, become too expensive for purchasers in other countries to buy. It remains to be seen just exactly what happens with the euro. We're going to talk about later on in these two half-hour segments. We're going to talk about both weak currency and strong currency possibilities for the euro. There was a chilling article that appeared in the Financial Times of London on Monday, May 18th of 1998. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This particular story, I think, could be viewed between the lines as something of a provision for economic martial law in Europe. And with the proposed closing of the MAI, sort of an international version of GATT and NAFTA and the EMU, I think that one can perhaps fairly extrapolate from what is being proposed now for Europe to the United States, because indeed the same conditions are going to apply here under the global economy, the new world order that apply in Europe. Listen very carefully to the article I'm about to read, because this is very chilling, and it says to me that the powers that be in Europe, read Germany among others, chiefly Germany among others, are getting ready to kick expletive deleted when the chaos that I suspect will naturally follow the institution of the euro takes place. Again, research credit on this goes to a listener. This is from the Financial Times of London of Monday, May 18th of 1998. This is an article by Neil Buckley in Brussels, B-U-C-K-L-E-Y, headlined, EU Plan to Ensure Free Flow of Goods. European Union countries could be obliged to take action to ensure goods can still move freely during industrial blockades of frontiers under plans to be discussed by ministers today. This first sentence again, because it's a doozy. Listen to the phraseology. European Union countries could be obliged to take action to ensure goods can still move freely from industrial blockades of frontiers under plans to be discussed by ministers today. The move is a reaction to a series of recent disputes, particularly by French farmers and truck drivers that have blocked ports and borders and disrupted millions of dollars of trade. Under compromise, plans drawn up by the UK, holder of the EU's rotating presidency, for a rapid response mechanism, unquote, in such cases, EU states would agree to a regulation emphasizing the duties of all member states to ensure the single market can function properly. Countries would also sign up to a political agreement that they would act swiftly to combat any disruption of the flow of goods during disputes. Although it has issued critical statements and warnings, the European Commission has proved powerless to deal with two blockades by striking French truck drivers. The compromise plan to be discussed today falls short of original Commission proposals, which would have given it new powers to take an emergency decision within days, forcing EU governments to take action. Ministers may also take a step forward today on dealing with the long-delayed plans for a European company statute that would enable multinational companies to set up a single corporate entity within the EU. But notice the phraseology in this article. European Union countries could be obliged to take action to ensure goods can still move freely during industrial blockades of frontiers. Skipping down again. Under compromise plans drawn up by the UK, holder of the EU's rotating presidency for a rapid response mechanism in such cases, and skipping down again, countries would also sign up to a political agreement that they would act swiftly to combat any disruption of the flow of goods during disputes. This says to me that the powers that be in Europe, chiefly Germany, are anticipating difficulties and that they are getting ready to kick a blank blank in case there are difficulties. Perhaps I'm wrong, but the way that article reads to me is basically as a blueprint for economic martial law. Perhaps our martial law, in all senses of the word, in Europe, in the event that disputes occur as a result of the European Monetary Union. That article again from the Financial Times of London of May 18th of 1998. That disputes are very likely to take place in Europe under the European Monetary Union is something that I think is a given, and indeed there have already been disputes. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who got the following from the Sunday Telegraph in Britain. This article is entitled French Accused of EU Sabotage. It's by Marcus Warren in Edinburgh. It reads in part, the French government was accused yesterday of systematically trying to undermine Britain's presidency of the European Union after officials from London and Paris clashed over the crucial issue of EU enlargement. Sharp differences of opinion were exchanged during an informal meeting of foreign ministers in Edinburgh. British officials say more confrontations seem inevitable before the end of London's six-month presidency. And skipping down, Paris has also threatened to veto the project of Britain's senior European commissioner, Sir Leon Britton, Brittan, to create a free trade area in services between the EU and the United States. A dispute's already arising, and it would appear to me to be altogether probable that they arise to a still greater extent in the future. What we're going to do now is to examine an article that I think is not only important in and of itself, but is significant in that it could be said to reflect the critical thinking of a section of the American elite. This article was published in the publication Foreign Affairs, issue of November and December of 1997. That periodical comes out courtesy of the Council on Foreign Relations, a major policy formulating body within the American elite. And I think to a certain extent this analysis can be viewed as not necessarily the analysis of the American elite, but certainly the critical thinking that the intellectuals associated with the American elite could be said to engaged in. I think the actual policies pursued by the American elite are very likely to be different from the critical thinking that is reflected in this particular article. This is critical of the EMU, and so far America has pretty much stood still while the euro was being put into effect. This article, again, is from Foreign Affairs, issue of November and December of 1997. The article is entitled EMU and International Conflict. It's authored by Martin Feldstein, F-E-L-D-S-T-E-I-N, a professor of economics at Harvard University and president of the National Bureau of Economic Research. So this is a voice to be taken seriously here. The article, again, EMU and International Conflict, Foreign Affairs, issue of November and December of 1997. It reads as follows. To most Americans, European Economic and Monetary Union seems like an obscure financial undertaking of no relevance to the United States. That perception is far from correct. If EMU does come into existence, as now it seems increasingly likely, It will change the political character of Europe in ways that could lead to conflicts in Europe and confrontations with the United States. The immediate effects of EMU would be to replace the individual national currencies of the participating countries in 2002 with a single currency, the euro, and to shift responsibility for monetary policy from the national central banks to a new European Central Bank, or ECB. But the more fundamental long-term effect of adopting a single currency would be the creation of a political union, a European federal state with responsibility for a Europe-wide foreign and security policy, as well as for what are now domestic economic and social policies. While the individual governments and key political figures differ in their reasons for wanting a political union, there is no doubt that the real rationale for EMU is political and not economic. Bear in mind that the EMU is the realization of the theories devised by Friedrich Liest in the 1840s, a pan-German theoretician and economist, for having an economically united Europe under the domination of a strong Germany as a vehicle for effecting world domination, and specifically for unseating Great Britain as the dominant power in the world. Well, now the dominant power in the world is the United States. Otherwise, the EMU would appear to be the precise realization of the theories formulated by Liest 150 years ago. Continuing. Indeed, the adverse economic effects of a single currency on unemployment and inflation would outweigh any gains from facilitating trade and capital flows from among the EMU members. These last two sentences again. While the individual governments and key political figures differ in their reasons for wanting a political union, there is no doubt that the real rationale for EMU is political and not economic. Indeed, the adverse economic effects of a single currency on unemployment and inflation would outweigh any gains from facilitating trade and capital flows among the EMU members. The 1992 Maastricht Treaty that created the EMU calls explicitly for the evolution to a future political union. But even without the specific treaty language, the shift to a single currency would be a dramatic and irreversible step toward that goal. There is no sizable country anywhere in the world that does not have its own currency. A national currency is both a symbol of sovereignty and the key to the pursuit of an independent monetary and budget policy. The tentative decision of the 15 European Union member states, with the exceptions of Denmark and the United Kingdom, embodied in the Maastricht Treaty to abandon their national currencies for the euro, is therefore a decision of fundamental political significance. For many Europeans, reaching back to Jean Monnet and his contemporaries immediately after World War II, a political union of European nations is conceived of as a way of reducing the risk of another intra-European war among the individual nation-states. But the attempt to manage a monetary union and the subsequent development of a political union are more likely to have the opposite effect. Instead of increasing intra-European harmony and global peace, the shift to EMU and the political integration that would follow it would be more likely to lead to increased conflicts within Europe and between Europe and the United States. What are the reasons for such conflicts? In the beginning, there would be important disagreements among the EMU member countries about the goals and methods of monetary policy. These would be exacerbated whenever the business cycle raised unemployment in a particular group or group, or in a particular country, or group of countries. This last sentence again. These, and referring to important disagreements among member countries about the goals of monetary policy, these would be exacerbated whenever the business cycle raised unemployment in a particular country or a group of countries. These economic disagreements could contribute to a more general distrust among the European nations. As the political union developed, new conflicts would reflect incompatible expectations about the sharing of power and substantive disagreements over domestic and international policies. Since not all European nations would be part of the monetary and political union, there would be conflicts between the members and non-members within Europe, including the states of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Conflicts would also develop between the European political union and non-European states, including the United States, over issues of foreign policy and international trade. Note the following, folks, because I think this is a harbinger of things to come. Conflicts would also develop between the European political union and non-European nations, including the United States, over issues of foreign policy and international trade. While disagreements among the European countries might weaken any European consensus on foreign affairs, the dominant countries of the EU would be able to determine the foreign and military policies for the European community as a whole. This last sentence again, because it's critical. While disagreements among the European countries might weaken any European consensus on foreign affairs, the dominant countries of the EU would be able to determine the foreign and military policies for the European community as a whole. And, of course, the dominant power in Europe is Germany. Continuing, a political union of the scale and affluence of Europe and the ability to project military power would be a formidable force in global politics. Although 50 years of European peace since the end of World War II may augur well for the future, it must be remembered that there were also more than 50 years of peace between the Congress of Vienna and the Franco-Prussian War. Moreover, contrary to the hopes and assumptions of Monet and other advocates of European integration, the devastating American Civil War shows that a formal political union is no guarantee against an intra-European war. Although it is impossible to know for certain whether these conflicts would lead to war, it is too real a possibility to ignore in weighing the potential effects of EMU and the European political integration that would follow. The next section of this article is entitled The Politics and Economics of Monetary Policy. The most direct link between EMU and intra-European conflicts would be disagreement about the goals and methods of monetary policy. The Maastricht Treaty established the European Central Bank and transfers all responsibility for monetary policy after the start of EMU from individual national central banks to the ECB. The ECB alone would control the supply of euros and set the short-term euro interest rate. Maastricht makes price stability the primary objective of European monetary policy, paralleling the charter of Germany's Bundesbank. The treaty also provides that the ECB would be independent of all political control by the member states and by European-level political institutions. Although the treaty states that the ECB will report to the European Parliament, this was intended to follow the Bundesbank tradition of an information report rather than any political oversight. These conditions are very much what Germany wants for the ECB and for monetary policy. Because of its historical experience, the German public is hypersensitive on inflation and fears any monetary arrangement that does not give primacy to price stability and insulate monetary policy from political influence. But German opinion differs sharply from the opinions about monetary policy in France and other European countries. The notion of a politically independent central bank is contrary to European traditions. Until recently, when Maastricht required all prospective EMU countries to give their central banks independence, most of the central banks of Europe reported to their ministers of finance, and the finance ministers were at least partially responsible for setting interest rates. The French have been particularly vocal in calling for political control over monetary policy. In a televised speech just before the 1992 French referendum on the Maastricht Treaty, then-President François Mitterrand assured the French public that, contrary to the explicit language of the treaty, European monetary policy would not be under the direction of European central bankers, but would be subject to political oversight that, by implication, would be less concerned with inflation and more concerned with unemployment. Mitterrand's statement was a political forecast. France recognizes that the institutions of the EMU would evolve and continually presses for some form of political body to exert control over the ECB. It has already made considerable progress toward that end. The December 1996 meeting of the EU Council of Ministers in Dublin emphasized that growth as well as price stability would be an explicit goal of future EMU monetary policy. It also established a new ministerial-level, quote, stability council, unquote, described as a complement, unquote, or a counterweight, unquote, to the ECB. Although this body falls short of one that could exercise political control over the ECB, it marked a first French success in establishing that monetary policy should be subject to some counterweight and that growth, that is, short-run macroeconomic expansion, as well as price stability, should be a goal of EMU policy. At the European Summit in Amsterdam in June of 1997, the newly elected French government of Lionel Jospin made further progress. The summit added an employment chapter to the Maastricht Treaty, emphasizing that employment is a parallel goal to price stability. More important, Statements by politicians at the Amsterdam Statement appear to have redefined the role of the political authorities in making exchange rate policy and, therefore, in managing monetary policy. More specifically, the Maastricht Treaty divided responsibility for exchange rate policy between the ECB and the EU Economics and Finance Council, which consists of cabinet ministers of member governments in an ambiguous way. The drafters of that part of the treaty, the German participants in particular, intended to limit ECOFIN's role to fundamental aspects of the exchange rate system and to leave to the ECB policies that cause short-run changes in the value of the euro. For example, a decision to fix the exchange rate between the euro and the Japanese yen permanently would be a decision for ECOFIN. In contrast, raising or lowering euro interest rates to increase or decrease the exchange value of the euro would be left to the ECB. Although this distinction was the German view, the French expected that ECOFIN, or ECOFIN, E-C-O-F-I-N, all capitals, would eventually get to give orders about short-run variations in the desired level of the euro exchange rate. The formal rules remain ambiguous, but the government leaders at the Amsterdam summit appear to have accepted a shift of responsibility for short-run exchange rate policy to ECOFIN. Since discretionary changes in nominal exchange rates can be achieved only by changes in monetary policy, this shift would establish a much more fundamental role for ECOFIN, a political body, in the making of monetary policy. One further recent development relating to the independence of the ECB is noteworthy. Members of the key Monetary Policy Committee of the European Parliament have called for a role for the Parliament in supervising the ECB, including its interest rate policies. They have specifically pointed to congressional oversight of the U.S. Federal Reserve as a possible model for such supervision. Although this arrangement may strike a reasonable balance between independence and accountability, parliamentary oversight would clearly be a major shift from the complete independence called for in the Maastricht Treaty, and, consequently, an area for contention. At present, individual European governments, especially in France and Germany, are suppressing their disagreement about the control of monetary policy to minimize the risk of political disapproval of EMU in their respective countries. But if EMU proceeds, the independence of the European Central Bank and the goals of monetary policy will become a source of serious conflict among member countries. The next section is called Inflation versus Unemployment. The issue of who controls monetary policy is closely related to the question of the proper goal of monetary policy. In recent years, because of the Maastricht Treaty's requirements for entering EMU, most countries have resisted the temptation to use monetary policy to reduce unemployment and have followed the Bundesbank in keeping inflation rates below 3%. But once the disciplining example of the Bundesbank is eliminated and monetary policy is made by an ECB in which all member countries vote equally, there is a strong risk that the prevailing sentiment will be for higher inflation. Over the past 12 months, international financial markets have anticipated that outcome by depressing the value of the Deutsche Mark, the French franc, and the other European currencies that move with them by 25% relative to the dollar and the yen. And I would stress that in late June of 98, as I'm speaking, the yen is plunging, dollar becoming proportionately more strong. Continuing, if the German public sees the inflation rate rise under EMU, it will become increasingly antagonistic toward the EMU arrangement and toward the countries that vote for inflationary monetary policy. Moreover, since an inflationary monetary policy would lower unemployment only temporarily while leaving the inflation rate permanently higher, the persistence of high unemployment would lead to political pressure for recurring rounds of expansionary monetary policy, causing continuing dissatisfaction among the anti-inflationary countries. Countries that are more concerned about unemployment than inflation might nevertheless be critical of the ECB for not pursuing an even more aggressive expansionary policy. Although countries have been properly reluctant to attempt such policies in recent years, they can regard their decisions not to do so as decisions they made themselves. But with a single currency, such governments would suffer the frustration of not being able to decide for themselves and of being forced to accept the common monetary policy created by the ECB. This general conflict about the governance and character of monetary policy would be exacerbated whenever a country experienced a decline in exports or other type of decline in aggregate demand that led to a cyclical increase in unemployment. The shift to a single currency would mean that the fall in demand in a country could not be offset, as it could be with an individual national currency, by an automatic decline in the exchange value of the currency, making its exports more competitive, and the decline in its interest rates, increasing domestic interest-sensitive spending by households and businesses, or by using its own monetary policy to shift interest rates and exchange rates. The ECB would have to make monetary policy with a view to the conditions in all of Europe, not just a particular country or region. The result would be a conflict between the country with rising unemployment and the rest of the EU. The next section is called Taxes and Transfers. Without the automatic countercyclical response of financial markets and the ability to use monetary policy to offset a decline in demand, European governments would want to use tax cuts and increases in government outlays to stimulate demand and reverse cyclical increases in unemployment. But the Stability Pact that was adopted under pressure from Germany tells governments that they cannot run fiscal deficits above 3% of GDP after the start of EMU. This is a very important pact because, as we're going to see, one of the reasons why many analysts are saying that the euro is going to be weak is because some of the countries that have ostensibly met this agreement are viewed as having fudged their criteria. One more time. But the Stability Pact that was adopted under pressure from Germany tells governments that they cannot run fiscal deficits above 3% of gross domestic product after the start of EMU. This restriction creates an important source of tension between countries with cyclical unemployment increases and the other members of the monetary union. The decision at the 1997 Amsterdam summit to weaken the application of financial penalties for violating this deficit ceiling would undoubtedly encourage more violations and, therefore, more quarrels about, quote, irresponsible, unquote, fiscal policies. We're going to continue with our analysis of the European Monetary Union and its implications. We're going to do that, however, in our next half-hour segment. All of the various half-hour segments, the archive documentary shows, the tapes of most of the lectures that I've done, and the weekly One Step Beyond shows from my home base station, KFJC, are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Once again, spitfire@ix.netcom.com. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. We're going to continue with our discussion of the European Monetary Union in the next half-hour segment. That concludes this half-hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.